Oh, the wonderful, delightful duo, Dinah Washington and Brooke Benton. You've got what it takes, and you've got what it takes, Coast listeners, to make my night. Thanks for joining me. You're great company. We'll get back to my conversation with Dr. David Kasseret, author of Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, and we'll talk about the use of medical marijuana in the treatment of cancer. If you go online, there seems to be just endless amounts of anecdotal evidence, people proclaiming that medical marijuana or marijuana can be used to treat cancer. Well, we'll separate the wheat from the chaff when we get back with David Kasseret right here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Welcome back to Coast AM, and we will open up the phone lines at the bottom of the hour as we continue our conversation with David Kasseret, author of Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. David, this will probably be sort of a rhetorical question, but so much resistance still, even from anti-drug abuse researchers warning against the use of marijuana. And yet, where are the long-term studies on many of the opiates that are being dispensed? We now have the FDA, they've approved this new. It's essentially a heroin pill, I guess, to help people with heroin addictions. But, where are the long-term studies talking about OxyContin and so forth? Why are they picking on marijuana?
Well, to be fair, and believe me, I'm not none of the business of apologizing for the DEA on this, but I think there is actually a fair amount of scrutiny of long-term opioid effects. And maybe I see that as a palliative care physician. Many of us have struggled over the years to make it okay to use opioids like OxyContin, morphine, methadone for patients who are seriously ill with cancer, often near the end of life. So I felt like I've been fighting an uphill battle to get my patients drugs like morphine when they need them. And I don't really see the fight against medical marijuana as being unique or different. It feels to me instead like we're fighting that same fight over again. And I finally gotten my patients with cancer able to get access, for the most part, most of the time, to opioids when they need them. And it seems to me like medical marijuana is now the next step.
Well, just to bring it back to OxyContin for a moment, there was a recent study up here in Canada by the CBC, our national broadcaster, and they uncovered a link. 1 in 8 deaths in young adults in Ontario, 1 in 8 deaths in young adults linked to OxyContin. I mean, how many people have died from recreational use of marijuana?
That is a great question. And the answer, ultimately, we don't know. However, it's worth pointing out that you can't fatally overdose, as I'm sure you know, otherwise you wouldn't have asked that question. You can't fatally overdose on marijuana. The way that most drugs like opioids or benzodiazepines like Valium cause death in the setting of an overdose is they act on the brainstem, the lower part of the brain, and they prevent us from reflexive activities that we need for living, like breathing. The interesting thing about marijuana and cannabinoids is, as near as we can tell, they don't have receptors in the brainstem. So you can take a vast amount of marijuana, smoked in edible form, for instance, either one or in other forms, and you may get paranoid, you may get anxious, you may get confused, but you can't fatally overdose. Having said that, I mean, there certainly are other risks of marijuana use, some theoretical risks of heart attacks or strokes, which haven't been substantiated. Certainly getting high and getting behind the wheel of a car could very easily cause death. So I don't think you could say that marijuana couldn't cause a death, but certainly just based on physiology alone, the risks seem to be a lot higher with opioids. And in fact, there was a study that came out about a year ago that showed that in the United States, in states that have legalized marijuana, both medically and recreationally, those states have seen a decline in opioid-related deaths, like the sorts of OxyContin deaths that you're talking about, which suggests that either medical users or recreational users or both may be turning away, at least in some cases, from opioids, turning to marijuana instead, which may have some other downstream side effects, but we might actually, through legalization of medical marijuana, be preventing those sorts of opioid deaths. Again, that's a correlation study. We don't know for sure, but that was a multi-state study that was really fairly large and well done, that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it's convincing enough to be very interesting to a lot of us who work in this area.
Tons of claims online. Documentaries have been made about this, but tons of claims online about the use of medical marijuana to treat cancer. There was a very high-profile case, for example, in Australia, where a man was arrested, separated from his, I believe it was his 2-year-old daughter, who had some sort of terminal cancer, and he was administering, sort of self-administering cannabis oil, and it seemed to be having some benefit, but that treatment was stopped when he was arrested. What can you tell me about the status of ongoing studies into marijuana and the treatment of cancer?
Yeah, you're right. There is a lot of attention online. And in the book Stoned, I spent some time talking to patients who had varying degrees of belief in marijuana oil as a treatment, including one woman I spoke with who was going through a difficult round of chemotherapy for lymphoma and decided to give up chemotherapy entirely and turned instead to using a marijuana oil that was very high in a combination of THC and CBD, mostly CBD. And a lot of patients, I don't really know what the numbers are, I'm not sure anybody really knows, but there certainly do seem to be a lot of patients who, either because of the hope of treatment or unwillingness to undergo side effects of chemotherapy and radiation therapy, or both, are turning to marijuana oil. Due at least in part to the work of a Canadian named Rick Simpson, who saw his cousin die of cancer back in 1972, and over a period of a couple of decades after that, became increasingly interested in the use of cannabis oil for a variety of conditions, including treating himself after a workplace accident in 2001. But his oils, which he used to make and now are made using his recommendations,
He calls them Phoenix Tears, I believe.
Phoenix Tears, right? Or at least that's the title of the movie that his story inspired. So there's a lot of anecdotal evidence. The research evidence we have right now is very, very limited. Limited as far as I've seen, really to laboratory studies. So studies of often tumor cells that are grown in petri dishes, essentially in cell cultures. And there's some interesting evidence, very, very preliminary, that shows that cannabinoids in that cell culture setting can reduce the rate at which tumor cells divide. Most interestingly, potentially, cannabinoids might actually reduce the tumor cells' ability to grow and develop new blood vessels, which is interesting because tumors need those blood vessels to grow and expand in the same way that cities need highways to grow and expand into the suburbs. If you cut off those blood vessels in the same way that you cut off those highways, then tumors can't grow. Those data, though, all come, at least from what I've seen, come from those laboratory studies. It's very, very premature, in my view, I think, for anybody who's got a serious cancer to stop taking chemotherapy and switch to the cannabis oils. And yet people are doing that. It may be that 5, 10, 15 years from now, things that we're learning in laboratories now will help to guide more effective cancer therapy. I wouldn't rule that out. I'm actually a little bit optimistic about that. But for anybody who's got cancer right now, it seems to me, and the recommendations I'd give my patients is your best treatment options still are surgery, radiation therapy, and the chemotherapy that we use all the time now.
Are you at least impressed by the volume of anecdotal evidence in terms of marijuana use for cancer treatment?
I'm impressed, but it's often hard to interpret those. I spent some time talking with a researcher who's also an oncologist named Donald Abrams at the University of San Francisco, and he's also a medical marijuana researcher. So he knows more, I think, about medical marijuana than any other oncologist out there, and he's done more research than almost any other researcher. So he is extremely well respected in the marijuana community, and I think he has a lot of optimism about what cannabis can accomplish. Having said that, though, he walked me through some of the cautions that he would advise me to use in looking at some of these anecdotal reports. One is a staging error. Sometimes doctors' scans are wrong, and what looks like a much more advanced cancer really isn't as advanced as what we think it is. And so when it improves, when it gets better, we think it's a miracle, when in fact it was just a staging mistake to begin with. He also pointed out to me that some cancers naturally grow and shrink over time, and you may look at a tumor and it may seem to get better after treatment with cannabis oil, but it may have gotten better anyway. And the other thing he pointed out was that people who give these anecdotal reports, including, by the way, the woman I described in the book, Stoned, use marijuana products with chemotherapy. And so sometimes it can be difficult to determine, well, how much of that was chemotherapy or even delayed effects of chemotherapy. So I'm not saying that these points negate the truth or the validity of all of these anecdotal reports. I'd say up front, we don't really know. But these are some things to use to be cautious about as we're looking at the anecdotal reports that we hear about all the time.
Now, my understanding is that Rick Simpson was essentially chased out of Canada, I believe, and now resides somewhere in Eastern Europe. Wouldn't it be better, rather than hunting these people down or chasing them out of the country, to sort of bring them into the fold and say to them, okay, let's see your research. Let's see, let me see some case studies and work with these people.
Yes, I think that's definitely true, and to some degree, I think that's happening, but it's happening in a really roundabout way. I'll give you one example, which I also used in the book. There's a filmmaker named Zach Klein, who worked as a medical marijuana volunteer in Israel. Years ago, as medical marijuana was becoming legal. The Israeli government realized that people were using marijuana for the first time, didn't know how to use it, and so hired these volunteers to train people how to use it. And Zach Klein was a marijuana advocate as well as a filmmaker, and began training people how to use it, and wound up making a film about some of his experience and some of the people he met. And so in the film, he described somebody with Parkinson's disease, actually, who found that after using medical marijuana, he could write better. And that single vignette in the film came to the attention of some Israeli researchers who decided to design a randomized control trial. So it's an interesting example of what I call in the book crowdsourcing medical marijuana research, which is kind of what you're talking about, identifying people who have these anecdotal reports, who are paying attention to these things down on the ground, out with patients, and making sure we get those anecdotal reports bubbled up to researchers who can test them in randomized control trials. And again, I mentioned the Kickstarter campaign we have for marijuanaresults.org, and that's kind of our goal, to give patients a chance to say, it seems to be working for me. And then another patient can say, well, yeah, it seems to be working for me too. Somebody really should study this in a rigorous way.
We'll open up the phone lines at the bottom of the hour and let listeners weigh in with their thoughts, questions, comments, and maybe their personal experiences with medical marijuana. Right now, it seems to be a bit of a patchwork across the United States, 23 states plus the District of Columbia. And I remember seeing a, I believe it was on 2020, this story about this couple with, again, a child suffering from severe epileptic seizures. They were in New Jersey, which is has not approved medical marijuana, or at least at the time of the airing of that episode. And so they resorted to picking up and moving all of their belongings to Colorado, which, of course, does allow for medical marijuana. But they are essentially prisoners of that state because they need to provide their child with cannabis oil every single day. Give me a sense of how it works in the United States. I know how it works in Canada. You have to go to a doctor, get a prescription. You can't go to a dispensary. I mean, there are dispensaries, but they're illegal. You have to get it through the mail and so forth. How does it work in the United States, in those states where it's legal? How do you get medical marijuana?
You're right. It is a patchwork, and it varies depending on where you are. In general, the approach tends to be that you would go to a physician, usually a physician, who would give you not necessarily a prescription, which implies that you are able to use medical marijuana in this way, in this form, for this reason, but a recommendation. So California is kind of the oldest experience in the United States, certainly one of the largest states, if not the largest, in which medical marijuana is legal. In that state, you'd get this letter of recommendation, you'd take this letter of recommendation to a dispensary, and you're able to get it legally. I will say, though, that you asked how this happens in states where it's legal. You know, honestly, it happens in states where it's not legal, too. I'm absolutely convinced that as a palliative care physician, quite a few of my patients are getting medical marijuana illegally. Some of them tell me, some of them don't. But it's available enough so that for most patients, at least those who are relying on marijuana, it's readily available in a smoked form as opposed to edibles or oils. They're finding other ways to get it.
But as it stands now, if you are in a state where it is not legal, medical marijuana is not legal, you're going to have to travel. If you want to be above board, you're going to have to travel and move to a state where it is legal. Correct?
Right. Yes. Yes, that's absolutely true.
And do you foresee a time when you will be able to basically receive your medical marijuana dose through the mail, regardless of which state you're in? I mean, is that the end game?
It's certainly the end game for many medical marijuana advocates and advocates in general, mostly because I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is the reason, or at least one main reason, you can't receive marijuana through the mail in the United States is, although it's become legal for medical purposes or sometimes for recreational purposes in individual states, it's still illegal at the federal level, and our postal service is federal. So again, I'm not a lawyer, so I may be misrepresenting the way that constitutional law is set up in the United States. My understanding is that you can use it in Denver, in Colorado, if it's legal in Colorado, which it is, but if you try to send it through the postal service across state lines, then you're doing something that breaks federal laws, and you're putting yourself at risk. I think the end game for a lot of medical marijuana advocates is to change that. I think that may be a challenge. The federal government in the United States has not been overwhelmingly enthusiastic about reversing its opinion, but you know, things certainly could change.
Well, what's it going to take? I'll ask you this question now. We'll head into a break in a moment, but I'll you know, what's it going to take for this conversation to happen in the United States? Dr. David Kasseret, my guest, and we will take calls, questions, comments, and your experiences with medical marijuana in mere moments here on Coast to Coast as the Beatles take us into the break with Rain. Welcome back. That's Kim Carnes, Crazy in the Night. I kind of like to think of that as my unofficial theme song. I will be back tonight, Sunday night, doing it all over again. We'll talk about money and the Vatican. Money in the Vatican. Acclaimed journalist Gerald Posner will be my guest to discuss the money and the cardinals turned financiers at the heart of the Vatican, the world's biggest, most powerful religious institution, including the political intrigue, inner workings of the Catholic Church, and the Church's accumulation of wealth and its Byzantine entanglements with financial markets across the world. In the first hour, Patrick Moore will be here. The co-founder of Greenpeace will address climate change, environmentalism, and why he left Greenpeace after 15 years to establish what he calls a more sensible, science-based approach to environmentalism. Your calls, questions, comments for Dr. David Kasseret, author of Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, coming up on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Dr. David Kasseret, my guest, as we talk about medical marijuana. And are you good to go to the phones, David?
Yep.
All right. Excellent. Let's dive in. And we go first to east of the Rockies. Robert is in Waco, Texas. Robert, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Coast.
Richard and Dr. Kasseret, is that with a C or a K?
That's with a C.
Okay. I'm a physician. It's great to talk to you. I'm really enjoying the show. I have had four back low back operations myself. I trained as a general surgeon. My last back operation was a multi-level fusion with interpedicular rods and bone grafts, and that destroyed my surgical career. I practiced emergency medicine for a couple of years until airway management became a problem. But prior to my last operation, I was on high-dose PO opioids, and very high dose, and they just were not doing the job. And I had an opportunity to have one of the finest neurosurgeons and one of the finest orthopedic spine surgeons in the country operating on me, but in waiting for their schedules to come together, there was a bit of a delay, and so I suffered quite a bit. Had a little bit of Coll-Aquina syndrome as a result of that, and my
Robert, is there a question, a specific question for David that you'd like to ask, Robert?
Well, yes. The question is, I think that the effect of opioids that are being used and supplanted for medical marijuana is doing a tremendous disservice to the American public. I'm suffering from a syndrome called OPIAD. I don't know if Dr. Kasseret is familiar with that, but that is, David, do you know what that is?
I've certainly heard of it, yes.
Well, it's opioid-induced androgen deficiency, and as a result of that, I've become hypothyroid, and I'm now a type 2 diabetic. I was probably Addisonian early on. The time that this was picked up, my free testosterone level had dropped down to 26, and my vitamin D level had dropped down to 11, which is a potentially lethal.
Robert, let me just jump in here if I could. Excuse the interruption, but now, did you say you used medical marijuana instead of opioids?
Yes, I did at the time, just prior to my last back operation, and it totally took the edge off. I mean, I was literally in tears, David. I could not control the pain any other way. I had tried marijuana on a couple of occasions recreationally, but that just wasn't for me.
Okay, Robert, I'm sorry to jump in, but I've got to move along. I appreciate your call. Thank you for checking in from Waco, Texas. Let's go to the wild card line, and Richard is in Roslyn, New York. Richard, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Right to the chase. I got a quick thing that I want to talk to you about, Richard, but I also want to ask David about something. He mentioned he treated or knows of a treatment of a soldier that had suffered from PTSD, and they'd given him marijuana and helped the situation. I'd like him to go into the mechanics of exactly how the medical marijuana helped alleviate the PTSD, and how much was it attributable to the stress relief that's produced when someone smokes medical marijuana, eats a medical marijuana cookie, or uses the medical marijuana oils. And also, David, for that matter, what do you think the effect of stress being alleviated in a person has for the natural ability of the person to cure himself to a multitude of many different diseases? For you, Richard, I wanted to ask, because everybody says the same thing, and so you said the same thing too, that the bad thing about marijuana is it destroys the, what did you say, ambition? Is that the word you used?
Yes, that's my own anecdotal evidence.
There's no question about that. If you look at a group of kids that start smoking and stuff like that, you seem like they kind of lose their get up and go. But if you look thoroughly at it, I smoked marijuana. I'm 70, but I smoked marijuana for about 25 years. I haven't smoked in about 25 years still. But I noticed that people, if they were type A achiever personalities, they would get as screwed up and as messed up on a weekend when they were out playing if they did recreational marijuana as anybody else. But they would go back on track. The ones that I noticed that became, like you said, lack of ambition, I question whether it's a lack of ambition or whether the social pressures causing somebody to be ambitious, once alleviated, allows the child or individual to be happy with the fact he doesn't have to achieve, he doesn't have to do that, and he just sits back and says, I don't want to do this, which is, I believe, the reason why the government doesn't like marijuana, because it does not promote everybody conforming to the social stresses that make people do what they do, go out, get a job, get married, have 2.3 children, white picket fence around the house in the country, the whole nine yards. A lot of people do it because they want to do it, but a great majority of the people do the things that are expected of them because simply they're expected of them.
That may be part of it. I have no way of knowing. It's an interesting observation. My only, I guess, response to that would be, well, a little bit of, you know, conforming ain't a bad thing. You know, it's sort of what makes this, you know, makes society move along. I guess I would take a little bit of umbrage with your analysis there. I don't know that you can be happy if you're not motivated to do what you want to do. And if you just want to sit around and smoke pot all day, if that's what you want to do, I don't know. I don't think that's a healthy thing. Let's get David in here to talk about the mechanics of how medical marijuana can alleviate post-traumatic stress disorder.
Sure. It's a great question. And just to be clear, I don't think we know yet whether and how it works. And by no, I mean through multiple high-quality randomized controlled trials. We know that a lot of people, as I said before, a lot of people use medical marijuana for PTSD. So a lot of people seem to be voting with their feet. And that's evidence of a sort. And it's evidence we have to take seriously. I certainly talk with a lot of patients in researching the book, and I've told stories in the book of stories that I've heard. We really don't know I think some of the evidence comes from the effect of THC mostly on reducing anxiety and potentially preventing some of the panic attacks that happen with PTSD, potentially improving sleep, more restful sleep at night. Some of the more interesting data on marijuana and PTSD, and this is much more hypothetical, but potentially more long-reaching, and has to do with your question about people's ability to heal themselves. And that is that there's some interesting data that comes from several people, including one researcher, Christine Rabinack from Wisconsin, who I talked to in researching the book. And she's not interested so much in using marijuana to treat PTSD symptoms, but she's wondering whether it might be possible for the cannabinoids, particularly THC, in marijuana to sort of uncouple people's memories from their experiences that lead to PTSD symptoms. So in other words, helping them to re-experience some of those events in a way that helps them to re-experience those without that overlay of anxiety and panic, you know, whether it's a rape or a murder, a kidnapping that people were involved with or witnessed that leave those traumatic scars. And she's done some, these are very preliminary laboratory studies, but interesting laboratory studies that show that small doses of THC might actually help people to deal with those memories, to uncouple some of their emotional weight. So again, that's very preliminary, but I think that's some interesting evidence that begins to answer your question about how medical marijuana maybe potentially someday might help people to heal themselves as part of ongoing therapy.
And on the downside, are there studies that show that too much THC can cause anxiety and paranoia and psychotic episodes?
Absolutely. And you know, honestly, any recreational user will tell you that's a risk. You don't need a lot of high-quality studies to tell you that the wrong strain of marijuana in the wrong dose, in the wrong hands, by people who are unfamiliar with its effects, can cause anxiety, agitation, confusion, and paranoia. In fact, if you look at calls to poison control centers across the United States over the last 10 or 15 years, every year there are more of these calls to poison control centers of people who have taken too much by accident. As we talked about earlier, you can't fatally overdose from medical marijuana, but you can have some pretty impressive and at least to some people scary symptoms. So that's certainly a possibility.
All right, back to the phones we go, and checking in west of the Rockies is Eric from Fairbanks, Alaska, where I believe they've had legalized marijuana for almost 40 years. Eric, welcome to Coast.
Oh, hi, Richard. Hi, Doc. We just had a vote, Proposition 2, last year, I think it was, regarding medical marijuana. Anyway, I voted against it. And I did because, let me share a little of my own anecdotal evidence. I went to school down on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington a year ago to study wooden boat building. Very permissive environment, as you might imagine. And I noticed a lot of the 18, 19, 20-some-year-olds who, I mean, were pot smokers. They'd show up late to class. They'd leave early. They were unmotivated. They didn't care. They were lethargic. I mean, just, I agree with what you said earlier, Richard. I mean, like, they'd fall asleep in class. And it's sad. I saw that. It was a waste of talent. And that's why I voted no on Proposition 2, which ultimately, you know, was a yes vote, and it won.
Okay, just point of clarification. Excuse me, Eric. Just point of clarification, okay, because I want to make sure I got this right. My understanding was that marijuana has been legal in Alaska since 1975. Is that so? You're saying that's not the case?
Well, from my understanding, it was, I've only been up here for 8 years. It was legal or decriminalized. You could possess it in your house, but I'm no expert on it. I can't speak to it. We just had a vote, I think, here. It was last year, legalizing recreational use. So it's just starting to spring into action, and you your dispensaries are coming up and whatnot next year here in Fairbanks. You know, they're just going through the whole rigmarole, kind of like Colorado is. But my second point is, I'm a, I served 10 years in the Army, 4 years in Iraq. I was 11 Charlie, an infantry mortarman. I was there in the invasion, and I was there through a lot of bad stuff. And I thought I needed alcohol, drugs, marijuana to calm my mind and a lot of the things I saw. So I went down to California after I got out of the Army, and I got a prescription for medical marijuana, and I smoked it, you know, left, right, up and down, thinking that's what I needed to calm myself down. And all it did was make me paranoid, scared. It made me hallucinate. It was horrible. And I realized about a year ago that all I truly need is fresh air, food, water, and, you know, that's about it. No chemicals, no substances, no mind-altering things. And that's my anecdotal evidence. I like to share that with everybody, you know, just so food for thought.
I appreciate the call. Thank you, Eric. Well, David, any comment on that?
Yeah, that's a great story. And I think the most important response is that's great. And I'm glad he's doing well. And believe me, I'm not trying to get everybody using medical marijuana. That was never my intention with this book, for PTSD or for anything else. I think my main goal is to make sure that people who make decisions about whether or how to use it do so with the facts. They need to know what we know about benefits. They need to know about what we know about risks, whether and when and how to use it. You know, arguably, I think if he and I had a chance to talk, I would have told him, you know, we really don't know whether it works for PTSD. You can try it if we want, but, you know, we don't have a lot of data. And I may have actually made the same recommendation. You know, we don't really know. We don't have good clinical trial data. So fresh air, good food, hard work, a supportive, loving family, you know, that's often what people need. I think the other thing we need to be really careful about on both sides of the fence, honestly, is, you know, hear these anecdotal reports of, I tried medical marijuana and it saved my life. And other people will say, well, I tried it and it just made me paranoid and it didn't work. Like, those are still anecdotes. And the saying in medicine is, the plural of anecdote isn't data, it's just more anecdotes. So I think we need to be cautious about taking anecdotes that are positive and saying, oh, well, this works, as well as taking anecdotes that are negative and saying, well, you know, it doesn't. Even for medicines that are approved, for which there are great data, you know, there's some patients for whom it doesn't work. So I think that the key point is that I'm not advocating the use of medical marijuana for anybody. We really do need better research, and people are right now struggling, as he was, to try to figure out what works for him, and we'll continue to do that until we have better studies.
No, got you loud and clear. By no means are you advocating. And Eric, I'm sure, was listening off the air, so your message got through. We're coming up on a break here at the top of the hour. We'll continue with questions and comments for Dr. David Kasserit as we talk about medical marijuana. One of the questions I'd like you to contemplate, and we'll get to it after the break, is how good are we collectively getting at matching the strain of marijuana to a particular ailment? For example, is there a strain specifically designed for arthritis or Parkinson's or post-traumatic stress disorder? We'll get to all of that and much more right here on Coast to Coast AM. Here's Otis Redding. That's How Strong My Love Is.